And you're very welcome along to the RTE Rugby Podcast. My name is Hugh Cal. Beside me today, Wes Liddy, RTE Rugby Editor and diehard Young Munster fan, and Mick Glennon from RTE Sport Online Department. Gentlemen, you're welcome ahead of England against Ireland this weekend.
Thanks, Hugh.
Looking forward to it?
I am indeed, yeah. I'm heading over and can't wait.
Yeah, I am looking forward to it now. I think Wes, after Wales, I don't think I would have been in the aftermath of the Scotland performance, but while I wouldn't say, you know, we're after moving on a heap amount, but certainly there's a lot more to be positive about after Wales than it was, I thought, against Scotland.
Yeah, it was probably, I suppose it was the performance we were hoping to get in the first game. It was like the real liftoff for this new kind of coaching ticket or team or however you want to phrase it. But yeah, there was some good rugby. I suppose there's a school of thought that Wales' defensive approach kind of facilitated that a little bit. But the truth's probably somewhere in between, in that, you know, Wales did some things badly, we did some things well. But either way, it's progress. And if there's a similar level of progress this weekend, you're in with a shout.
That's
so,
it, yeah.
Even if you don't win this weekend, I think if you maintain the performance again, I think in large, you're still probably in a pretty positive place.
Yeah, and I guess the question is, I mean, how good are England now? And it seems a bit stupid to say that, given what they did to New Zealand in the World Cup, given they went to the final and had all the gears to go and win it and didn't do it. But since then, Mick, it hasn't seemed like a particularly happy camp.
Yeah, it could be a microcosm. The semi-final to this final could be a microcosm of it, so that they get up for a huge performance and put in a stunning performance against New Zealand, and the heights that they reached and that they just weren't able to replicate that the week after. So if you take the high of the year and the World Cup run and where they are now, and the talk from Eddie Jones before the France match, and then they didn't turn up, or they got bullied off the park, which they had intended to do. And then I guess the Scotland match would probably do a bit more for them than you would think, because it was just a miserable match.
That was atrocious. Conditions were awful.
But in terms of team spirit and digging out a result in terrible conditions, what that does for a team, that actually gives a good bounce, yeah, to get over the line that way. So,
yeah, it's hard to know what to make. Look, we're going to speak to Donal McRae in a few minutes' time, who author, of course, Sports Journal with The Guardian, and also worked on Eddie Jones' book, just to get a kind of hopefully a bit of insight into how Eddie Jones is these days. But like, maybe it's a little bit easy to dismiss England on the back of the last two performances. France obviously losing, and then Scotland, they weren't great in atrocious conditions, but we know they have all the tools to put a performance in.
Yeah, like, it's complete cliche, but there does seem to be a hangover from the autumn, however you want to label that. But there was certainly a bit of a flat vibe around the camp, and some kind of selections that were a little bit difficult to understand, and some unusual, not that that's too unusual, Eddie Jones making unusual comments in the media, but to be honest as well, I think they're just a different team without the three Bash brothers there, the two Vunipolas and Tuilagi. I mean, it's a completely different equation. There's no getting away from it.
Yeah, in terms of what they bring, in terms of how the opposition has to cater for them.
Consistently winning collisions, putting them on the front foot, their presence on the field, you know, even creating space for others by just people having to be cognizant of them all the time. I think just the pure physicality, athleticism, ball in hand, threat they bring, I mean, you just can't really replicate that. I mean, they're huge. I was going to say one of a kind, but they're three of a kind, I guess.
Tuilagi is in line to come back in, so I reckon if he's fit, he should start.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously Eddie Jones names his team tomorrow, Ireland unchanged. So just on that then, I mean, was there anything that Andy Farrell was likely to do, given how well they played against Wales? Were there any positions that you thought might have been up for grabs this week, Mick?
No, because of the performance itself against Wales was enough. I mean, the only shout was Deegan dropping out and Doris coming back in, which once he was fit, it was probably likely to happen, because Doris won the foot race for the Scotland match so, you know, it kind of takes care of itself. It's not the most imaginative, but I mean, there's a very tough job to be done. Ireland have won once in Twickenham since 2010. It's a very difficult place to go, so you know, it's horses for courses.
No, it's set up nicely. Look, if you were looking for someone to inspire you ahead of Twickenham against England this weekend, would you take Bono or would you take Paulie? And as a Young Munster fan,
Bono,
I think I know your answer.
Yeah. Yeah, listen, they're all, like, not to be putting things down, but I mean, gimmicks sounds like it has a negative connotation.
But they kind of
are,
though.
They're things to break up monotony and start a conversation. And, you know, maybe they say one thing. That Eddie O'Sullivan was telling me one time that they were in Italy. On, I'm not sure were they in camp or were they about, they were about to play Italy in the Six Nations game, and they said, listen, we're going to have a speaker there, so let's all come down to the team room. And Kevin Maggs was sitting in the front seat anyway. He's a massive boxing fan, you know.
Yeah.
And Eddie's like, you're going to love this, lads. And in walks Jim Neely.
Right.
From BBC Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
But Jim Neely then proceeds to mimic the Las Vegas ring announcers and introduces former middleweight champion of the world, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, walks into the room.
You're joking.
Kevin Maggs fell off the chair.
Oh my God.
Shock, and they loved it. They've been like, talking about it ever since.
No disrespect to Jim Neely, but the lads are like, you're going to love this.
Jim Neely had commentated on Hagler versus Leonard or one of the fights.
Yeah.
So went there and recreated the whole thing.
Fantastic.
And he lived in Italy, Hagler. He was a star in spaghetti westerns after he retired. So they got him in, and that seemed to strike a chord because it was so novel. So who knows?
Exactly.
Interestingly, Stuart Lancaster, when he was in charge of England, he would get in speakers like that from different codes. So Kevin Sinfield, Gary Neville come in, Andrew Strauss come in just to G them up. So Farrell would have been there at that stage under Lancaster, and maybe he's seen there's something in this where they were talking about trying to reinforce the Irishness thing, that identity that got Bono in to speak to that, or whatever that means.
Yeah.
So it's something maybe he picked up off Lancaster and thought that it worked.
Yeah, I mean, look, they've had a couple of weeks.
It's good to all English coaching ticket or hammer home the Irishness, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe did they feel like they had to go five steps over the other way just
to too much?
Look, lads, yeah. But sure, look, anyway, we'll find out, I suppose, what influence that had on the team this weekend. As I said, an unchanged side. You were in camp this week with Andy Farrell. How was he? Did you find him? Okay,
yeah,
relax.
Very nice.
Two out of two? Sure.
Yeah, sing when we're winning. And the English media were over. There was a handful of those guys over, but he was very nice, short and sweet. We were talking about Paul O'Connell coming in, which you can understand, and then Bono for the bit of motivational speaking. The one I found very interesting was he was asked if he'd been speaking to Joe Schmidt, and he said, yeah, I spoke to Joe a few times. Obviously, he's not been in camp or doesn't quite know what we've been trying to do, but it's great to get some feedback. So I just was a little bit surprised at that. I thought, from Joe's point of view, I thought he could have done with the separation, because the original point of him stepping down was that he had been 24/7 looking after Ireland for 6 years, Leinster 3 years before that.
What was Andy Farrell hoping to learn, do you think, from Joe Schmidt that he didn't the previous 6 years? Or
I don't know, but even with Smith's, the way he conducted himself, you know, he was in charge of everything, and I thought that maybe the separation would do both sides good. If you know how long it's only 3 months.
That's
since
a strange
Joe's
one.
Gone.
No? That's bizarre.
I was a little
depends
bit surprised.
Depends how
about.
Formal it is, I guess, and to what extent it is, but it certainly. I suppose it tallies with a lot of opinions of Joe at the minute that he struggles to let go or to switch off, you know.
Or was it a case that Farrell actively sought him out? But I find that a bit.
Yeah, I mean, we don't forget that Joe is a brilliant coach.
Sure.
And he did unprecedented things for Ireland. But again, it's just.
But this is the new era, though. Like,
yes.
You know, it's to have any kind of lingering back to Joe Schmidt, I thought, you know, make the clean break. Anyway, let's hear from the man himself, Andy Farrell.
We use a few clips, so you know, as any team would do, but not real motivation. It was a warm up game. That was two teams on probably different levels. You know, we come away from training camp in Portugal, really hadn't done any type of contact work whatsoever during that week. So it was probably at different levels, which every team is in a pre-season warm up game. But it still stung. The performance from England was excellent, and we know that what they're capable of. So we don't look too much into that. Probably the game in the Six Nations or the start of the last Six Nations was more of a fairer balance of where they was at as a team. Again, started really well, fast, explosive, used an attacking, kicking game to great effect. Pinned us into the corners and try to hit us on the counter. You know, I suppose there'll be a bit more of that at the weekend as well.
Andy, how much of a motivation is it for you that the last time you played in a World Cup warm-up match under a previous coach, you were walloped by 50 points? Is that something the players feed into? No. Zero. Zero. It's completely irrelevant, isn't it?
Even that it was a World Cup warm-up match, I mean, that was a sickening. That was kind of an embarrassing defeat. It was unacceptable at the time. All the talk during the week was about this great training camp in Portugal, and they're all set. But that was frankly embarrassing to ship a record defeat.
But sure, who cares? I mean, honestly, it's a World Cup warm-up match. I mean, honestly, I couldn't give it. It's no relevance to this game whatsoever.
I don't think it's going to be a prime motivating factor anyway, for sure.
No, I don't think so either. Just on Farrell then, before I leave it, like, you know, he's gone up against his son this weekend. And
he
just,
again, though, he has gone up against him several times.
As a head coach in charge of Ireland versus the leading main man for England, like, it just brings a bit different dynamic. I know it's happened loads of times before, but it is him standing kind of toe to toe against the son. It's a little.
He dead batted all those questions yesterday. Really? So there was maybe four or five at the press conference, and he didn't go into it at all. I know last week he had opened up a bit more, saying how difficult it was maybe for his wife Colleen Owen's mum and his sisters and his grandson, who would be Owen's kid. Yeah. So. But yesterday it was all, I've spoken to him two or three times. I was talking to my grandson. And then the one he was asked, as a head coach, is Owen Farrell more dangerous at out half or centre? And he goes, you tell me.
Yeah, okay. Right. Well, look, he's not going to give too much away. Just in terms of the England team, before we bring in Donald as well, like, I'm looking at the side that played against Scotland. So McAvoy Ponell is out, obviously. Jamie George, Sinclair, Atoji and Cruz in the second row. Ludlam at six, Underhill at seven, and Tom Curry, the back row. I mean, Curry got an awful hammer against the Scots. He wasn't particularly good against the French either. Why is he persisting with what is clearly one of their best blindside forwards at number eight? Surely England have been more number eights than that.
Yeah, they were phenomenal in the World Cup, but I think, like, and Billy Vunipola was probably a little bit, not disappointing, but maybe not quite what we quite expected in the World Cup. But he just lets those two play a different game. They can just get on with that role as a, you know, as a fetcher and a breakdown nuisance and all the rest. Whereas, you know, he's definitely looking to do some different things playing at eight, obviously. So I think it just upsets the whole balance, you know. Not to mind that there's a new guy in there in Ludlam as well, who is new and frankly isn't as good a player as what he's replacing.
Yeah, that England pack wouldn't put the fear of God into you.
I think the tight five is still pretty good, in fairness, now.
Not bad.
There's a lot of muscle there. Like, they're bullies to a degree, and if they get on top of you, especially at home, I think they can kind of revel in that a bit. But equally, you can buck that trend, maybe, you know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as I mentioned, Donal McRae is waiting on the line, a sports journalist with The Guardian, and of course, author of several sports books, including work with Eddie Jones. Donal, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Hugh.
So, just first of all, can I ask you what the mood has been like since the Six Nations kicked off in England, given the highs of the World Cup and how brilliant England were for large parts during the World Cup? Has the attitude shifted somewhat over the last few weeks?
It certainly has. You know, I'm a South African, but I've lived in England a long time, but I'm always quite amazed by how the mood in England shifts so quickly. It's not so long ago that, they beat New Zealand, got to the World Cup final. But I get the feeling that City, I think the English media, rugby media, are kind of fed up with Eddie Jones. And not that there's a campaign to get him out, but I think there is a lot of hostility towards him. So, that opening defeat in Paris certainly changed the mood quickly. The honeymoon lasted quite a long time because he is an entertaining guy. But when things started to go a little bit amiss in sort of 2018, where England had a long losing run, I think Eddie felt the media were being particularly harsh on him. And while he's fairly open to the media, I think on that occasion he started to put the boot back in and also just got a little cheesed off with some of the questions. So I think things have not been so good since 2018. And then obviously World Cup year, things were, much better. But in some ways, he's quite dismissive, I think, of English media. He feels the standard of rugby journalism is far better in New Zealand, South Africa and Australia, which I'm not sure is correct in that.
As in the understanding of the game and how journalists write about the game?
I think so. I think he feels down in the Southern Hemisphere there is a deeper understanding of the game. Personally, I think the standard of journalism in the UK and Ireland is higher. And I'm saying that as a South African. But yeah, there's been a little bit of an undertow of, I wouldn't say animosity, but of, I think they're both kind of perhaps tired of each other.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's fair enough, because you know that tends to happen when you have these long term relationships. Sure. With the media, sometimes can turn. I think back to last summer though, and the documentary that went out about England's preparations for the World Cup campaign and how focused the player were. It was fantastic insight into the training that went on, the camaraderie it seemed to exist between the squad itself, and how Eddie Jones was kind of just, you know, manipulating everybody to his will. And we use the word hangover at the top of the podcast here in relation to what's happened since the World Cup. Is that a fair assessment, that the players maybe just are a little bit jaded after putting so much into the World Cup campaign?
I think so. I actually interviewed James Haskell last week, and obviously he's no longer playing, but he was part of that squad until sort of 2018, and he still goes in to see them. And before they played France in the Six Nations, he did a session with them. He was saying to me that he actually feels the players are still quite buoyant under Eddie Jones, and there's still that good atmosphere. But I think there has been the aftermath of the Saracens fiasco, which I wouldn't say it's caused divisions in the squad, but I think it's been quite a headache for Eddie Jones to deal with the aftermath of that. And yes, I think he feels the players are jaded a little bit physically and mentally. And he always said to me, you know, after a World Cup, it's particularly tough for the two finalists to lift themselves quickly. And so I think there's a little bit of that.
Okay, so the team is named tomorrow. The back row I'm really interested in. Is Tom Curry going to stay at number 8, Donald?
I'm not close to the scene anymore, so I'm fascinated as you, but I actually don't know the answer.
Okay.
Eddie can be quite determined and some would say stubborn in his thinking. He certainly, you know, in the last two matches is saying that he feels Tom would work as a number 8. But I don't know. I'll be fascinated to see how that plays out. I've also heard there's been a lot of talk about a change of hooker. Lucas and Dickie might come in, but that's just what I've seen in the papers down here.
Okay, and I'm just wondering as well, I'm curious, before we let you go, about the English view on the Irish coaching setup at the moment. Obviously, we have Stuart Lancaster, who's playing his trade with Leinster and doing very, very well with Leo Cullen. Andy Farrell is now head coach. He's got Mike Cash with him. Graham Rowntree is with Munster. It's fascinating, really. I'm wondering, are the English fans kind of going, well, why are we letting all these coaches out of our grasp?
Certainly, from the outside, it seems like those English coaches are doing well in Ireland. And it seems with Andy taking over, we've heard that, you know, that the mood is much more amiable and sort of players are enjoying sort of a slightly looser stance than under Joe Schmidt. So, yeah, I think the English fans are looking here thinking, well, we could have two of some of these English coaches too.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, it's, obviously, we're looking forward to the game. Enjoy it, Donald. Thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Super. Okay. So look, I mean, Eddie, the tide's starting to turn against him. He is one of these coaches, though, Wes. You know, he's liable to say anything, but the flip side of that is that he leaves himself open to these punches, and it does seem like now the media's starting to turn against him. Whether or not the fans care about that is another thing.
Yeah, I suppose it seems very all-encompassing when his time with a team, you know, because he's so omnipresent in the media. And then also, you know, he's publicly on the record as that getting this team to be the fittest in the world was, you know, massive priority. So there was times during his tenure, I suppose, where they were actually like actively conditioning in camp, whereas most teams aren't. There's the kind of emotional high as well as the physical toll of the World Cup. I think the Saracens thing, not in terms of division, but just in terms of another mental drain on people.
It has to affect the players.
It has to affect the ones directly involved.
That's what I mean.
It has to.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no doubt it's a drain on their thinking process.
Season's dead rubber, the relegation from next year, their future's up in the air.
Yeah, I mean, like anyone, when you've a lot going on, you kind of get dragged in a few directions. You get fatigued. So
and Eddie Jones isn't the type, as the kind of arm around the shoulder type.
I wouldn't be surprised if he was, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
I think anyone who's been successful for that long at the top and who's managing kind of groups of 30 or 60, if you include backroom staff, of like mostly male, like huge egos, highly
alpha types,
competitive environment, like. Anyone who can do that well is a multifaceted guy. He's a very capable man, I'm sure, in many ways. So I wouldn't be at all sure that the image he puts out to the world is the real one. I met him at the Six Nations launch a couple of weeks back briefly. And Yeah, again, another cliche, but he was remarkably different in tone in a one-on-one conversation than anything I've ever heard from him.
Yeah,
in front
he's
of
a
the
fascinating
microphone.
Guy, I have to say. Like, he just is.
Yeah, I guess if we're dealing with, when we're kind of very used to some certain Gaelic games managers and soccer managers and the rugby managers we deal with, you know, they're very careful, circumspect in what they say. Never throw out a line that can be pinned up in the dressing room, as they say, and then Jones goes the other way. And from our point of view, that's good value.
When it works, it looks great. But,
I think you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't as a coach with the media. Though, I mean, like, you use the GAA example, and like, one would be, like, one that always comes to mind for me is Brian Cody, who wouldn't be mentioned as necessarily the most electrifying post-match speaker. And people say, oh, he'll say nothing. And I kind of go, no, he's actually saying everything. You know, when he talks about an unbreakable spirit that can't be broken, or these kind of things, like, he's telling you what there is. Just because it's not sexy enough what you want to hear doesn't mean it's not true. So you go that route, you're boring. You go Eddie Jones's route, you're a troublemaker. You know, what do you want? They have a job to get on with without dealing with the media.
I'd rather the Eddie Jones approach every day of the week, I have to say, just personally speaking. But as you say, it seems to be almost management speak. They have to give as little away as possible. And as you say, it depends what you're looking for.
Yeah, it'd be a duller tournament without him, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to focus on the Irish performance, if we can, for a few minutes, delighted to say we have Lynn Cantwell on the line with us. Lynn, how are you?
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah, we're kind of convincing ourselves here that Ireland are going to give these guys a good rattle at Twickenham on Sunday. Would you share that confidence, or how do you feel?
Oh, yeah, look, I think so. Like, I think the thing that's going in England's favour is the fact that it's in Twickenham, it's a fortress, it's hard for them to lose at home, etc. But, like, they're not playing well, and I think there is this big old hangover post-World Cup, and, you know, they're kind of asleep, aren't they?
Yeah.
And they've obviously lost Vinopolo back home and lost other Vinopolo to injury, etc. So, like, I definitely think Ireland have a big, big shot of it, but, like, England could easily switch it on because they're not a bad team, you know, they're just a good team playing poorly.
And is that your sense of it, because we were talking to Don McRae about it, but you're living there obviously at the moment. Are the English fans that you're kind of talking to, do they believe that they can turn the corner this weekend, or is there a bit of a doom and gloom about the whole squad?
No, look, you know, English ego is an incredible thing, and I think
an incredible thing, Lynn.
incredible thing, yeah. I think there's definitely a big blind spot to England ever doing poorly, so I think they obviously look at it kind of objectively and think, oh, of course, you know, England are going to beat Ireland. But, like, if you actually look at pragmatically, I think that Ireland have a very good chance of doing it, because I think they're beginning something potentially exciting. I think there's definitely lots of belief in the squad, there's belief outside of the squad, etc. We recognise that they've only performed well once in this Six Nations, and it's only been two games, so who knows what's going to happen next. But yeah, look, England think that they're going to perform and compete at the weekend, but questionable.
Wes, Peter Manny obviously was dropped going into the opening game for Ireland, came on very quickly with Caelan Doris getting a head knock, and it does seem to have been a bit of a spur that maybe he needed, or maybe didn't need, but certainly it's done the trick. Whatever, his performances have been very good in the last two games. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think CJ particularly, even more so. You know, two man of the match performances, and he was definitely on the chopping block. But I don't know. I mean, I don't think it was ever going to be the kind of wholesale changes that some people were crying out for. And it was real knee-jerk stuff after the World Cup, and understandably so with the disappointment. But when you look at it now, he's actually changed quite a bit. As much as possible without tearing up the whole thing. You know, Larmour has obviously come in there, played every game.
Conway.
Conway, Rory Best is gone. There's been a few young guys brought onto the bench. So he's kind of evolved things nicely without a complete revolution. And I think that was always the way it was going to be. There's no players coming onto the radar surprisingly in Ireland. We know what's available. There's only four teams. We see them every week. So. Yeah. I think he's done a very good job in handling the start of the campaign so far.
What about your position, Lynn, outside centre? So we're hearing that Manon Talangi is probably going to be back in for England this weekend at 13, himself and Henshaw going head-to-head, if that's the case, which would be a fascinating battle. But, like, I think a lot of people would like to see Robbie Henshaw really kind of take that jersey and make it his own over the course of the next few weeks with the injury to Gary Ringrose. What's your sense of Henshaw as an outside centre? Do you like him?
Do you know what? Like, I think I prefer the style of Gary Ringrose because I like expressive players. I like exciting and unpredictable players. And that's what Gary is, as opposed to Henshaw. But if you look to Henshaw's performance against Wales, he was the one who ignited their tries. He was the only one that was offloading. He got to the outside shoulder twice. That led to two of Ireland's tries in the first half. And it was kind of similar to last year, you know, a couple of players that were kind of just igniting a little bit of spark or trying something a little bit different, like Josh Van de Vleer, etc. Like Henshaw was one of the players in the last game that did that. So I really respect that. So I would hope that he gets the credit where deserved, that he can do that. I think naturally he's known more for his kind of route run one type of player, but he's a sensible, he's a clever player, he's a good decision maker, and I really respect that as an outside centre. I think that's a big, big skill too. So,
and he hasn't had a huge amount of time at 13, like, because if you think back to even under Joe Schmidt, he was largely a 12 inside Gary Ringrose, and I've heard Brian O'Driscoll speak about this huge amount of times that, like, developing a sense of understanding in that 13 position, even defensively, let alone without the ball, takes an awful lot of time and takes a lot of kind of air miles on the clock before you feel fully comfortable. So maybe with the run on it now, we're going to see the best of them.
Yeah, true. Like, there is a big range at 13. I know, like, you kind of say that. I know that's your position, but that's what I felt, is a big range of what you need to be capable of. Definitely a decision maker is huge. But the ability, because you've got so much more space, and equally because you've got faster players in your zone and coming into your zone from every different angle, you need to have the ability to be able to kind of navigate that. So you do need a big range. I don't think he has naturally got the range that, say, Ringrose has, but, like, he's grown into it. I think he has the capability to have it. But you're right, he just needs probably a little bit more time there, and it probably won't come as instinctively to it, but he'll do a damn good job because he's a very, very clever player, and I think that's a key part for that position.
And they're big boys, aren't they? Like Bundy Aki and Robbie Henshaw in the Irish midfield, like, that's a big centre combination.
Yeah, and even as Lynn was saying there, it was great to see Henshaw doing what he did against Wales before he had to go off for the HIA, because he's long on record as to say he would much prefer to play in a more open space, be that outside centre or full back. So it was like he would have been in the mix for that position if Ringrose had been fit, barring Ringrose was having a brilliant season. So he became undroppable then because of his form with Leinster and his form just in the World Cup. But before that, they could have just been both going for the same jersey with Aki there in at first centre. So, no, I'm delighted to see Robbie Henshaw back, and space will be a bit tighter, I would imagine, against England. But something similar would go a long way to help Ireland.
The criticism you might have, Wes, is that maybe the centres...
I'd take Ringrose every day of the week.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But he's not there now, right? He's not there. He's not there.
He's not there now. But I mean, on the bigger thing, I kind of don't get the debate of that someone needs time to develop in the position when there's someone there that doesn't need time and is doing a fine job in the position. So I agree with Lynn. I think Robbie's kind of viewed as a bit of a talisman for the team sometimes, and I think actually...
Well, he's had that label for a while, but has he actually delivered on that label?
Well, this is what I'm saying. I actually think when you look back over the evidence is actually that the team functions far better as a unit with Ringrose in there because he's a natural in that position.
Yeah.
Now, look, it's redundant to this point, but... No, I mean, at full strength, I'd have Ringrose in there every day of the week.
Absolutely. But maybe, is there a concern, Lynn, then, that maybe, you know, we know the pace that the Conway, Stockdale has, Larmour as well, that the back three mightn't get as much ball as we'd like to see because of that centre combination? Bundy Aki is a very physical, hard-running centre. Is his pass off his weaker hand the best in the world? Probably not. Robbie Henshaw as well, distribution better against Wales, but probably can go up another couple of notches. You'd like to see the back three involved as much as possible, but I don't know if we're going to see that at Twickenham on Sunday.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's a really important criteria when you're looking at certain positions, and definitely centre partnerships, that criteria of 12. So, like, you pick them as a pair, I suppose. And I suppose what we have with Aki and Henshaw is you do slightly, not negate, but you slightly negate the ability to go wide sooner and to get the boys, the back three, handing the ball sooner, etc. So there is that's one of the downfalls of it. Yeah, but look, as I said, it's as a result of injury, and he can do it, but I just don't think it'll be as quick, as it won't be as instinctive. It'll be a little bit more predictable to read from a defensive point of view, which will make it a little bit less effective. But equally, you can adjust for that. You know, if they're aware of that, you can get the ball earlier, you can stand deeper, all of those different things. So it's I presume they're going to apply the game plan with that in mind. In order to try and get the ball into the back three's hands, because they're a big threat.
I'm looking here at the weather as well for Sunday. So precipitation 80%. So I mean, it looks to be kind of a miserable.
Stick it up there, Marie. Right. Like follow it up and see what. Look, can I ask you about the Ireland women's team over the last couple of rounds, Liam? Because you know, don't harp back to last season too much, but certainly there does seem to be a huge improvement on the basis of what we've seen in the first two games. Happy enough at the midway point, or how do you think Adam Griggs will feel?
Yeah, look, I think they'll be delighted with it. I think they went into it with the goal to win their home three. And whether that's like, you know, an average enough goal or not, who cares? That's what they went into it. So let's just look at this season. So they've started well, obviously started well against Scotland, found their feet a little bit. And, you know, saw the sprouts of a couple of rising stars with Bevan Parsons, etc. It was a shaky enough game at the same time, you know, because if Bevan hadn't got that intercept try, Scotland came back and got a try and they could have won it. But either way, they backed it up. I think that was the most important thing against Wales in obviously horrendous conditions. But what we saw in that game, which we haven't seen before, and it would have been a criticism in the last couple of years, understandably, when you haven't got kind of a maturity within the squad. But we saw some good decision making and some good game management, which we haven't seen before. So when they were trying to be conservative with the wind at the start, then they decided to try and kick. They realised then that Wales weren't very good at recycling the kick and kicked it back quite quickly. And then that's what Bevan's try came from. So that was a good just demonstration of they were learning as they were going. And then there was a momentum shift. The Wales started to take it back, but Ireland took it back from them. They kicked well, etc. So I think what we were seeing in this game and what we're seeing in this campaign is more advanced learning, which we haven't seen in the past. As I said, a couple of good young talent coming through.
Claire Cohan at Fly Half, Lynn, she's seen impressive in very difficult conditions the last day. Is she the future at 10, do you think?
Oh, look, you, 10, going back to our conversation about centre, 10 is a position that you need an awful lot of time in. I don't think she's had that time. Definitely a club, she's had a little bit, but it's a whole different standard. Kyo, what she does have, what Ireland completely lack, is a kick. So that's great. She obviously needs to learn how to use it and when to use it, etc. And then her second big task is obviously igniting her back line, which is a whole other skill set, which I don't think she has yet. She's fresh enough. But look, there's not too many options. That's not to devalue Kyo at all. She is a great player and she really wants that. She definitely plays for the pride of the jersey, and she'll give it everything she got. But you know, it's tough to throw her in there, and the expectation of this year is they need to qualify for the World Cup and through the repertage, and you need an experienced 10 for that, especially when you have an inexperienced 9. So there's a lot of off-pitch stuff that needs to be done with her to get her up to that standard. But you know, they have the likes of Senne Niupu feeding in what needs to be done, etc. So that can buy her some time.
They'll be eating this weekend, won't they? I'm not trying to like, I mean, I you know the England team inside out as well.
Now,
I just
Lynn,
cannot
take your endless cannot, positivity there
I cannot
and
see,
sort it
I cannot
you.
See any way for this women's team to go and beat England in the backyard. I just can't see it happening.
No, look, it's tough because, you know, there will be rotation from the England team, etc. But like Doncaster, sold out crowd, their performance so well at home. England are on such a rampage to try and win the World Cup, and every single game is aimed towards that. And they're a bloody brilliant side. So they will if Ireland stand off them, which I doubt that they will, England will have a field day. Like they beat Scotland, I think it was 53-0 or something, or 53-5 last weekend. But like Ireland do historically play well. Ireland women do historically well against England, at least for the first 60. So I hope they do, because they you can always learn an awful lot from those games as an Irish player. So they use it hopefully as an opportunity, as opposed to just go out there and get pummeled.
Sorry to end on a negative note, then. It's typical me, yeah. Anyway, look.
A realist.
Thanks a million for your time. Enjoy both matches. Thanks, Lynn. Nice one.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Ireland's women's and men's Six Nations Championship games live on 2FM this weekend on Sunday from 12:30. So back-to-back coverage of the women's and men's game. And yeah, look, let's just talk briefly about the other couple of games this weekend, because I'd love to see France go and beat Wales, I have to say, and then, you know, could set up that old Paris showdown depending on what happens this weekend. But the French do look good, Wes.
Oh, yeah. They're definitely the most exciting thing in the championship. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, it's great.
Sure. I was a massive fan of French rugby growing up. All my favourite players were French players. Mm. Loved watching them. Some of the days they beat England in Twickenham kind of against the grain with like Lamaison or Castagnette or whoever was the man of the moment at the time. They're rivals and competitors, I suppose, but I'd love to see them back relevant for a while now.
I love the fact that they went out against the Italians and just didn't care about defence. I'm sure Sean Edwards ate the heads off them the following week, but they just went out and said, you know what, we're in Paris, we're going to beat them, let's play a bit of rugby. And they did. Like, Baptiste Sarrain's try was as good a try as you'll ever see.
A couple of serious stars emerging now as well. I mean, they were promising Ollie players Vaughan. For a couple of years, but there's a couple now that really... I mean, DuPont is probably the best player in Europe at the minute.
Incredible scrum half. Yeah, brilliant. And Ntamack as well has grown hugely, and he was getting a lot of grief as well.
A lot of people would think that, I know from talking to Mike Prendergast, that a lot of people over in France think Jalibert is actually more potential than Ntamack.
Yeah.
There's more to come in. There's, you know, Raka isn't there. Yeah. Damien Penault hasn't been there much. Mm-hmm. Like, it's there's serious talent there. It's exciting.
Frightening, yeah. Brilliant.
We'll see now, because obviously they've had two home games and now it's France on the road, which was the old traditional thing with French clubs and France.
And I wonder what Wales got left in the tank.
They've
as
been
well.
Very bullish Wales since the Ireland game. A lot of the players talking about we can still win the championship. So I think there will be a bit of a kick in them at home. So it will really test like France's.
Well, that's where Sean Edwards is going to come into his own, isn't it? Because the French have to be switched on here. It'd be so typical of France to go out and expect to win and just get blown away by Wales. Like, Sean Edwards is going to have a huge role in making sure they're right upstairs.
I think they're too, that and the Ireland-England game, they're both like very hard to call at the minute, I think.
Okay, well, let's call it then. Right, go on, Mick. France-Wales, who are you going for?
France-Wales. I think Wales will win that in under the closed roof.
Okay, I'm going to go with France just because I want them to win, as opposed to that I think they'll actually win 50-50. I'm going to go with France now. What do you reckon?
I'll go with France on the same basis as you, but yeah, I probably think Wales will win narrowly. Okay. Pushed.
And England at home?
Yeah, it's tight. I mean, I think there's a lot of question marks about both teams. We're not quite sure exactly where either one are. Probably just on the basis that if they play their best at home, they win. I'd probably narrowly go for England, but with no real confidence, and obviously hope to be proved emphatically wrong.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Ireland. I just think England, the doom and gloom and the performance levels, I know the conditions are off against Scotland, they just were...
Yeah, do you know what? I'm going to go with Ireland too.
Okay, good stuff.
I'm scrolling down here. 1968, Twickenham, Five Nations Championship. A 9-all draw.
9-all draw. You're going with that?
Going back to 1968. So what about a draw?
Okay, right. Okay, we'll go with... Okay, so we have a draw and we've gone for two Ireland wins. Very optimistic way to finish the podcast. Thanks for listening in. I hope you enjoyed it. We're back next week to look back on the England game and, of course, ahead to Italy.